This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, it's Megan Williams. Every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from this week's edition of the Sunday Magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. You can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. Let's turn our lens to the Paris Olympics. The Summer Games kicks off on Friday, and millions will gather to watch some of the world's most elite athletes compete at the highest level of sport. But this year, there will be more challenges than striving for a place on the podium. Paris may be the hottest Olympics on record, and the effects of climate change on sports go beyond rising temperatures. In her new book, Warming Up, sports ecologist Madeleine Orr explores the many ways our changing planet is changing sports and what the future of events like the Olympics may look like if more action isn't taken. Madeleine, good morning.
Good morning.
How did you first become interested in the connection between sports and climate change?
So I grew up skiing in Eastern Ontario, and for those who are from here or know it, our mountains are more like hills, and we used to have a pretty reliable season. You could reliably get Christmas right through Easter type time, and now it's getting shorter and shorter every year. And so I thought, well, I'll go to France and have a better season opportunity over there. And I got out there to work a season, and we had bad snow, and it was very much the same story there, and it kind of served as a wake-up call for me. I thought, well, it can't just be winter sport that's impacted. Everything is going to be impacted by climate change. And once I started thinking along those lines, I couldn't unthink it. I couldn't unsee it. It was everywhere.
And you started looking around at other sports, I guess.
Exactly. And summer sports really came into light for me in Rio. I started seeing what, you know, polluted water is going to do to athletes, how golf courses are literally falling into the ocean if they're coastal. And you know, it's going to be a different story depending on what sport, what part of the world. But any outdoor sport is exposed to the elements. And so as those change and conditions worsen, athletes are going to feel it.
Now, the Paris Olympics kick off next week and are set to be the Olympics with the highest temperatures on record. What changes will we see from previous games, which will help athletes cope with the heat?
So in Tokyo, you'll remember we saw a few events shift times, and that's relatively new. We didn't used to do that, but it also didn't used to be 35 degrees with Humidex. So in Paris, we can expect some of our schedules might shift a little bit as we go, depending on what the conditions are. We might expect to see more medical provision on the sidelines so that, you know, we don't think of cooling towels as medical provision, but it absolutely is. Hydration breaks are going to be implemented in various sports for the first time. Football across the whole sport now has new policies. We saw them in Copa. We'll see them again in Paris. And then in the water, it's going to look like real clear checks every day and multiple times a day on water quality and water temperatures, depending on where we're talking about, whether it's the Seine for open water swimming or the paddling events just outside the city or surfing in Tahiti.
Yeah, there's been a lot of attention about the mayor making the Seine River clean enough to swim in for the first time.
Yeah, it's a 1.4 billion euro cleanup project, which is an amazing amount of money invested into making the Seine swimmable for the first time in 100 years. It's still just clearing that threshold of being safe. So one really bad rainstorm could undo some of that. But I am hopeful that it's looking up for some of the athletes who are going to be in the water.
Yeah, that would be absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, you share a really terrible, heartbreaking story about a young college football player who died from heat stroke in 2018 after an intense outdoor practice, and cases like his are becoming more and more common. How does intense heat put the lives of healthy athletes at risk so quickly? I mean, what happens in the body that makes this just so dangerous?
So when we exercise our bodies, one of the things that's happening is we're producing movement with that exercise, but we're also producing heat as a byproduct. So that's why you get huffy and puffy and sweaty when you exercise, and especially in outdoor conditions. Now, if you don't cool the body down as that heat is building and you don't take a break, that heat can continue to build. And when it does, there's a couple of things that happen. The first thing is you might experience cramping, nausea. That's because the blood is going to your skin to try to cool you down instead of taking care of your inner organs and going to the muscles. And so that's what cramping is. That's where the nausea comes from, the headaches, etc. If we don't have an intervention, which it doesn't have to be complicated, it can be as simple as get some electrolytes into you and some shade, we could see that become devastating pretty quickly. It takes about half an hour to reach devastating levels of heating. And that is what happened with Jordan McNair. We've seen it happen with 50 young men in the U.S. in American football just in the last 20 years.
Who have died. Wow.
And so I spoke to a few families who have experienced that. And the parents want everybody to know that this can happen. And it doesn't necessarily look like much at first, but we do need to cool athletes down. It has to be about safety first.
And obviously the problem there is people are just weren't aware of what was going on. So what are those measures that you can take?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people just chalk it up to they must be having a hard practice and they're not necessarily thinking the heat is playing into this. So the things to look for if you're a coach, a parent, an athlete, you want to be thinking about, is it hot outside? Is the Humidex high? When's the last time you took a break? Are you well hydrated? And can we pre-cool the body before you get out onto the field? So that might be a cooling vest. It might be sit inside before you go outside. Like, don't do the whole practice outside or shorten that practice if you can.
The heat isn't the only problem. Last year, the skies over much of Canada and the U.S. were yellow from Canadian forest fires. And those kinds of forest fires are not going to go away. We see them every summer, not just in Canada, but in many places around the world. How are they impacting the way people are playing outdoor sports?
Yes, that's another big piece is the breathability of the air that we are consuming. And so with wildfire, you're getting extra sulfur in the air, you're getting extra pollutants in the air. And when you breathe through your mouth, which is typically what you'll do when you exercise, you're bypassing your body's natural filtration system, which is your nose. And so you're taking more pollutants in directly into your lungs, and therefore it can reach your bloodstream faster and have devastating effects in the long term. It's not something you'll notice right away necessarily, unless you have long COVID or asthma or another underlying respiratory condition. People who have any of those should be really on the lookout as soon as your air quality index gets into that mid-range, anywhere from 4 and up. We want to think about it. But really, for all sports, as soon as it's 7 or 8 or higher, we need to stop the practice outside.
So you're saying the athletes won't really notice that? They won't be short of breath or there aren't signs necessarily?
If it's really high, you'll feel signs. You might have itchy eyes, for example. You might have some coughing. Coughing is good. Coughing is the body system of getting rid of those pollutants out of your system. So it's a good response. But it's not necessarily the case that it's going to immediately impact your performance on that day. And so that's why it might feel okay to like, oh, I'll just do the 5K run today. Don't do it. Save yourself. You're going to feel those impacts a few days down the line.
And what about when the smell of burning and the, you know, the discoloration in the sky is cleared? I mean, are you safe at that point if you've been out in these conditions?
So not necessarily. You always have to pay attention to that air quality index. That's going to tell you whether it's safe to be outside and exercising in those conditions or not. It doesn't necessarily look like anything, right? Air pollution doesn't look like anything. In the case of wildfire, it'll look yellow. It might look hazy. But it can just as easily be ozone. It can be mixing with other things. If you're in a city, especially, you want to be thinking about all those other pollutants that are going to mix with that air quality and potentially make it bad for a longer period of time than just what you might see.
Now, there's so much pressure on athletes, particularly athletes at a high level, to kind of motor on through bad conditions. And that's what goes into training. You have to deal with a lot of pain. You have to just push through it. How much does that training of an athlete and that outlook of what it means to be an athlete affect the fact that they're being put in risky conditions and maybe not protected enough, as we've seen with these deaths from heat stroke?
So it's a huge challenge. There's this whole be tough, have grit mentality that is pervasive in sport, especially when you're working with coaches who are maybe from a generation where you would just power through and we wouldn't be thinking about things like concussions or injuries back in the day. Now we're much more aware of it. The more you know, the more you can do, right? You can't do better if you don't know better. So we now have the information to be aware of things like air pollution and heat. athletes know when they're uncomfortable. They're just not necessarily going to tell you that because they're worried about losing that playing opportunity or that next step up, right? And these are very competitive environments. These athletes are known, they're trained to essentially switch off their amygdala, mm-hmm. the system in their brain that's going to tell them stop.
Yeah.
Right. This is where the rest of us around sport have to provide that environment where it's safe to do that. So whether you're a parent or a coach or an administrator in sports, this is where you come in. You have to make sure athletes are aware that they should come to you if there's something wrong, that they can say, I need to stop and take a break, and that it should not have impacts on whether they get to play in the next game. Different people are going to experience climate impacts differently. Mm-hmm. Your body might be different than mine in terms of how we handle heat or air pollution, etc. And so it's not about whether that person is not gritty enough to get through this. They just might be experiencing it more severely than you are.
Is there enough being done to make coaches aware and say, look, you're responsible in these situations to keep your athletes off the field?
It's slowly coming into focus. It's been a long time coming. There have been, actually in the U.S., there's been two now murder cases where coaches have been accused of murder and brought into court around that for losing athletes in their care. And that has really put the onus on coaching staff and managers to have policies on this. So across Canada, we are developing policies for heat and air pollution. They're not widespread yet, but that's coming into play. And it's a duty of care we have to each other. We have to take care of each other. And that next game is not more important than someone's life. So that's where we have to start shifting the conversation. I know the Sport Information Research Center in Canada and a lot of academics are working on materials to get that out there to make sure the education is available, but we have a long way to go.
Okay. Now, in the past week here in Toronto and in East Coast Canada and elsewhere, there has been some pretty severe flooding. Storms are getting much more intense. In Toronto, a month's worth of rainfall in one day. How is increased flooding going to impact sports going forward?
Yeah, so if you're on the East Coast, you definitely know about flooding. We've seen less of it in Toronto and in the prairies and in the West than in the East, but it's starting to pop up everywhere, like you said. Most of our sports facilities in Canada are built on traditional floodplains. And the reason is because typically we're not putting homes there, we're not putting businesses there, and so we put sports fields or a golf course. So you are more likely to see sports fields flood than just about anywhere else. And it's good that they flood because it means that that flooding is not impacting other critical infrastructure. But that flooding can also damage a pitch to the point where it's not playable for days or weeks afterwards. And then we have to be thinking about, and it's not life and death stakes, but we have to be thinking about how do we continue to play sport and have fun in these conditions and preserve opportunities. We all saw what happened for kids when COVID shut down sports. This is an important social outlet. It's an important developmental outlet. And for adults as well, it's a fitness thing. It's a social thing. You know, we have to be thinking about how we take care of people. So floods are going to continue to happen. We have to be aware of that. And whether you're on the water or on the field or on a track, we have to have secondary places to go to continue that, whether it's into a gym or somewhere else.
Right. Or on higher ground.
Exactly.
Or whatever. Yeah. Now, as you mentioned at the beginning, you got interested in this topic through skiing, and winter sports like skiing are really facing an existential threat right now. And that's as temperatures get warmer and the snowy season gets shorter. I've certainly seen it in the Italian Alps, where, you know, the lower part of the ski slope is green now. Yeah. When you know, even 10, 15 years ago, there was snow on it. What will winter sports look like in the future?
So we are going to see some resorts close, unfortunately, and we've started to see that happen. Just last year in Japan, a few closed. In France, we lost two. And like you said, Italy is starting to struggle, especially at lower altitude. In Canada, we can expect that our west skiing is going to be fine out west because it's at higher altitude. It's a little more insulated. But in the east, we're going to start to see that go away. And it's not necessarily that it's all going to shut down tomorrow. But we have a 100-day rule in skiing that to be economically viable, you kind of need 100 viable days. And we're getting dangerously close to that number. And so as that starts to get crunched, you can expect to see the price of ski tickets go up in order to compensate for those lost days. And that will make it even less affordable than it already is for a lot of families. And so we can expect to see participation decline, and that will start to activate that cycle of shutdown. So hopefully that's far enough out. And we can, the good news is we can avoid a lot of that if we start acting on climate change in a little bit more of an aggressive fashion right now. But some of it will already be locked in. So we can expect to lose some resorts in Ontario and Quebec.
I mean, in your research, are these little villages and little towns throughout the world that rely or essentially economically dependent on the ski season, are they starting to come up with plan Bs, or are they getting prepared for this?
Yeah, and you'll know it as soon as you walk into a ski town. You'll start to notice there's a lot of bike shops all of a sudden. There's a lot of mountain bike facility. We're starting to see more hiking programming, summer camps, those kinds of things. We're going to have to continue to see that. They're going to have to diversify their revenue streams if they're going to survive. And like you said, this is whole communities. It's not just the resort itself, the ski mountain. It's the hotels and the restaurants and everything around it, and the communities that have been built on that. So as the conditions worsen, as winter becomes more scarce, we are going to have to see some shifts there.
Now, the impacts of climate change, not just for sport, but for anything, we know are very uneven throughout the world, and with the poorest and most vulnerable, the most affected, and those people are from countries that aren't producing the CO2 emissions. Kenya is a country that has produced some of the world's fastest long-distance runners, and it is struggling with the acute impacts of temperatures and drought. Can you tell me what's happening there?
They, like you said, produce some of the best runners in the world. And it's two things. It's the culture of running is really strong. But the other part of it is they traditionally have had the best conditions to run in. They have these perfect clay roads. They have beautiful sunshine and good conditions. That's starting to go away. It's becoming too hot to run in the middle of the day. So the timing of their training is shifting. It's becoming too hot to sleep at night. That's impacting how they can recover. But it's also the clay roads are being impacted by drought. And so we're starting to see lower extremity injuries. That's your knees and your hips and your ankles.
Oh, wow.
That we never saw before. And so they used to have this perfect surface to run on, better than, you know, pavement or what have you. And now it's hard as rock.
The famous barefoot runners.
Exactly right. Yeah. And so we're starting to see that shift. Now, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. We're not going to see a skyrocket in injuries, but we're starting to see a pretty steady uptick the longer this drought goes on. Same thing in Ethiopia and nearby. So that's a big challenge. And like you said, these are countries that don't necessarily have the resources to adapt quite as quickly as we might.
You're listening to The Sunday Magazine. I'm Megan Williams. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with sports ecologist Madeline Orr about her new book, Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. And as we gear up for the 2024 Olympics, Madeline, you traveled to Rio for the 2016 Summer Olympics. In your book, you describe being stunned by the level of waste and consumption you witnessed at those games. Can you paint a picture of the environmental toll an event as massive as the Olympics has?
Yeah, so you can imagine that when you have tourists at that those numbers, right? In Paris, we're expecting 15 million tourists. That's double the population of Toronto, just coming in for a couple of weeks. You can imagine how much waste is produced in Toronto. If you live in Toronto, you will remember the garbage strikes and how awful that was. Rio felt kind of like that. It was just an extraordinary amount of additional waste being added to the city waste streams with regular waste collection processes, right? And so it's not like they're going to change their whole waste protocol for 2 weeks, even though there's that much more waste. It's not something you think about right away, but when you bring 15 million people together for what's functionally a big party, this is what happens. And so Paris is equipped to, they actually have more waste streams coming in, more waste trucks coming through. If a neighborhood ordinarily would have, you know, once a week collection, they now have two, et cetera. But it's overwhelming how much waste is produced.
And what is Paris doing to try and mitigate the environmental impact of the event?
The organizers in Paris, to their credit, have been the most forward-thinking on this of any games organizers, I would say, in the last 5 or 6 decades in terms of how they're thinking on sustainability and climate change and what they're going to do. They've cleaned up the river, like we said. It's not perfect, but it's a huge improvement. They have gone to energy-efficient buildings using existing buildings for everything except the new aquatic center, which is great, so there's no construction. They are thinking about how people are coming into Paris, so they're encouraging people from within Europe to be taking the train and facilitating that through train partnerships, etc. And then their mobility in Paris has really extraordinarily improved. So they have additional 400 kilometers of bike lanes, 12 new bus routes that all will remain permanent after the game. So it's accelerated a transition for the city.
Yeah, I was in Paris recently, and it's a city transformed in terms of, I mean, everybody's getting around on bike lanes, electric bikes. I mean, it's a much quieter city than it used to be.
It is, and cleaner smelling.
Yeah. No, it was just such a pleasure being there. You know, one of the things that affects people in my profession, journalists, is the use of generators.
Yeah.
That's changed as well, right?
It has. So they actually used to have generators, fuel-based generators, for every broadcaster on site at a games. They no longer have that. So at these games, everything is on the grid, and the backup plans are also on the grid, separate grid. So that's a huge improvement and something that will be a legacy for these facilities. So all of these sports facilities that will host other events over time will now not rely on generators.
Now, one really interesting part of your book for me was the whole concept of climate advocacy through sport, which I have to say is something I had never thought about before. What kind of conversations would you like to see happening in the world of sports about climate change, and why is sports a really important place for that conversation to be happening?
So for most people who live in urban areas in North America, we don't necessarily have very close connections to nature anymore. And our introduction to nature and the way we connect with the natural world often is through physical activity and sport. It's your bike ride to work or your walk to the store or your kid's soccer practice, as the case may be. And so those opportunities become opportunities, in my view, to have a conversation about what's going on in our natural environment. Now, athletes are facing these conditions every day. It's part of their job. And so they are particularly effective at communicating what those changes look like. There's a few good examples in Canada. Evan Dunphy, a race walker, he was a bronze medalist in Tokyo. He's competing in Paris. He often will do little videos on his Instagram, for example, where he's walking around Richmond, BC, talking about how he's walked Richmond more than anybody else. And, you know, here's how great the walking path is, or this is what the air quality is like today, et cetera. That goes a really long way in letting people know what's going on in their own communities, but also in telling people that when we play outside, when we take advantage of these spaces, we have to love them back. We have to take care of that space and protect those protected lands across Canada, but also just as simple as our local football field.
And the amazing platform that athletes and sports events have in terms of reaching out to millions of people.
Absolutely right. Athletes are second to none in terms of how influential they are. So research out of MIT has looked through who the most influential people in society are back to the 1500s. And since 1950, it's been athletes, and it hasn't gone away from being athletes.
And yet some people don't, you know, in that world don't want to get the message out necessarily. I mean, what's preventing that from getting out more?
So as much as athletes have a huge platform because sports has a big platform, everybody wants to get a piece of sports, right? And so over time, we've seen different industries come in and try to use sponsorship or ownership to leverage the sports platform to sell a product, whether it's cereal or Gatorade or oil and gas, for example. And there are the powers that be in sport that want to continue with big consumptive lifestyles, you know, airlines and petro and all these other things. And so it can be tricky if you're an athlete and you're playing for a team sponsored by a certain property that might not have as good a record on climate change. It can be tricky politically to raise your voice on this.
Now, beyond the Olympics, what policies would you like to see major sports leagues and government agencies put into place to mitigate the health dangers that we've talked about and climate change in general?
So I would love to see a few things happen. The first thing would be air and heat policies. Almost every sports property in the world has a rain and lightning policy because we recognize lightning is unsafe. Expanding that to a weather policy that includes other unsafe conditions is not that hard to do. But I'd also like to see work go into things like carpooling, public transit to and from sports sites, not just for fans, but for anybody going there. There's hundreds of workers at your average baseball game in Toronto, for example, right? Like, you have to think about, how is everybody getting here and going home? So more public transit, more carpooling, and more of a conversation around how do we protect these spaces long term and use them as a hub for community engagement. And we used to do this really, really well. During World War II, we used sport facilities as emergency centers. During COVID, we used them for hospitals and resource distribution. We can continue to do that. Sports can continue to be the center of our community, not just in good times, but in bad. But we have to have that as a real conversation.
So looking into the future, if more action is taken against climate change in general and in sports, can you paint a picture for us of what the Olympics might look like in, say, 2050 or 2080?
Yeah. So we can expect to see a few things change. The first thing is, on the winter side, we're probably looking at a rotation of cities that have climate-reliable conditions. There's only going to be a few that are reliable in terms of the snowfall if we continue on our current trajectory. So that would be one thing. It's going to be a rotation, not necessarily a new place every single time. On the summer side, we also have issues because there's not a whole lot of really big cities that aren't getting really, really hot. And so that's a separate discussion we have to have. I think the big piece on the summer side is going to be the scale of the event. It can't continue to be 15 million tourists. That's an untenable number. So figuring out how do we make sure that the athletes have their parents in the stands, but that beyond that, we don't have all of this travel and tourism happening, that it's more of a local, smaller scale down event. The media will still be there. We'll all still get to cheer it on and watch it from home. Maybe we have fan zones happening in Toronto and Vancouver and Calgary, but not flying all around the world for this. And then at the community level, I think we just have to build in conversations with our kids around, if you're going to play on the soccer field, it is, you are part of the group of people responsible for taking care of this soccer field and, you know, our kids' generation, et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of things that I would love to see. A lot of them are starting to happen, which is really exciting, and conversations that are ongoing, everything from the International Olympic Committee right down to, you know, MLSE here in Toronto working with youth sport.
Right. Are you optimistic?
I mean, I have to be in my line of work. Yeah, I am. I think there's, you know, we can avoid every worst case scenario if we work on it right now. It doesn't mean that there's going to be no losses, but we can minimize them. And isn't that worth fighting for?
Madeleine Orr, thanks so much. Excellent book. And really interesting talking to you about this.
Thank you so much.
Madeleine Orr is an assistant professor of sports ecology at the University of Toronto and the author of Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Megan Williams. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.